For the next three Sundays, I want to talk about marriage. And today I'm going to talk about marriage, and I'm going to talk about divorce some, and what breaks the marriage covenant, and some of those things. And I'm going to end talking about being single and how some people have the gift to not be married. And then next time I'm going to talk mainly about the wife's duties in the marriage. And the third Sunday, then I'll talk mainly about the husband's duties in the marriage. So don't feel bad if I don't beat up on you today. I'll probably get you next time. And if I don't, then it'll definitely be the third time. You know, this is an important study. It's important because marriage is a picture of Christ and his bride, the church. And we saw that in Ephesians 5:22 this morning, that which I read for the call to worship, that you know, that the marriage covenant between a man and a woman isn't just a marriage between a man and a woman. It is a picture of the marriage of Christ to his church. So it's very important that marriage, that Christian marriage, looks like and acts like it should be, because it is a picture of something else. And if the marriage is not what it should be, then it's giving a false picture of what Christ's marriage to the church is. This is important because marriage was God's design for mankind even before the fall. Marriage was not something that came about after the fall. God did not design men to live in singleness before the fall, and then after the fall, this was some plan B that God had. No, this was God's plan for mankind from the very beginning. And if you look in Genesis 2:21-25, it says, "And the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon Adam, and he slept. And he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh instead thereof. And the rib which the Lord God had taken from man made he a woman, and brought her unto the man. And Adam said, This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh, for she shall be called woman, because she was taken out of man. Therefore shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. And they were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed." And Jesus quotes this verse in Matthew 19:4-6, and tells us that this was God's plan from the very beginning. Matthew 19:4-6. There's a lot of controversy about marriage these days, but we ought to go back to the scripture and we ought to look at what God says about it, because God is the one that created it in the first place. It was not a civil institution. It was not civil governments that created marriage. It was God that created marriage. In Matthew 19:4-6, Jesus said, or it says here, "And he answered and said unto him, Have ye not read that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female? And said, For this cause shall a man leave father and mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh. Wherefore, they are no more twain, but one flesh. What therefore God hath joined together, let not man put asunder." God joins men and women together. This is not, I mean, the civil institution is part of it. And the vows that they make are certainly what creates the covenant. But it is God that joins two people together, a man and a woman together. This study is important because marriage is also the cornerstone of the family and of society itself. It's a no-brainer that marriage is the cornerstone of the family. Break up a marriage and see what happens to the family. It's a very difficult situation. But marriage is also a cornerstone to society itself. Look at what's happened to our society in the last, say, 50 years maybe, whenever divorce rates have skyrocketed. You know, now half of all marriages fail. And then it gets even worse with second and third marriages. But just look at what's happened to our society since then. There used to be a day when people generally didn't get divorced. I mean, it was a rare thing. People just stuck it out, slugged it out, and just painfully dealt with it, even if they couldn't get along. And I don't think marriages, I know marriages don't have to be that way. There have been, if you read books on marriage, there have been lots of counselors that have fixed terrible marriages where people thought there's no hope. They don't love each other. There's no way we're going to be able to make this work. And a lot of times it can be made to work. But anyway, my point is, just look at what's happened to society in the last 50 years with the breaking down of families. This study is important because there is a war being waged by the devil on marriage and on the roles of the husband and wife within marriage, so as to destroy the picture of Christ in the church and undermine God's law and to destroy the family in society. So Satan has a big assault, and it's obvious. We can see in this country over the last half a decade, I mean, there's been a major assault by Satan on marriage. And the gay marriage thing, quote unquote, is just the latest round of that fight. I mean, that's just, that's another one of his wiles. But it started on waging the war on traditional marriage. So this is, it's very important to be solidly grounded in what marriage should be. And lastly, it's important because we can't change the world, but we can change ourselves, and we cannot be conformed to this world. So we're not going to go out there and we're not going to change the world. We're not going to change the course of human events, more than likely, but we can at least change ourselves, or we can do the right thing, and we can save our own families by God's grace and His help. Now, as I usually do, I want to start out with some definitions, and then I'll get to some more definitions as I get through this. But first of all, let's define marriage. Marriage is the condition of being a husband or wife, the relation between married persons, spousehood, or wedlock. That one's pretty self-explanatory. I don't think that was probably a surprise to anybody. A husband is the master of a house, the male head of a household. Secondly, it's a man joined to a woman by marriage, correlative of wife. Interesting that the primary definition of husband is not a woman's husband, you know, a woman's partner. And the same is true for a wife. This is even more interesting. I'll bet you did not know the primary definition of wife when I read it here. Primarily, it's a woman, formally in general sense. So way back in the beginning, wife just simply meant a woman, which may not be all that surprising. Then it says, in later use, restricted to a woman of humble rank or of, quote, low employment, especially one engaged in the sale of some commodity. Now, I must say I've never read anywhere, in everything I've ever read, I've never read wife used in that sense. I don't think. You know, when you talk about a wife, you're not talking about somebody that trades wheat or cotton or gold or whatever, you know, or soybeans. You know, generally you're talking about a man's spouse. That's what we normally think of. Number two, it's a woman joined to a man by marriage, a married woman correlative to husband or of husband. So no rocket science here as to what husbands and wives in marriage are. Now, since God created marriage, He therefore defines it and puts guidelines and restrictions on who can be married in His Word. So if He creates it, then He can control it. That makes sense, right? You create something, you control it. You create your kids, you control them for a while anyway. And then you send them off on their own. But when God created Adam, He said that it was not good that man should be alone. And so He made him a suitable helper for Adam. If you turn back to Genesis 2 and verse 18, you know, God made people as social creatures, and He knows that we generally don't do well just locked up in a convent somewhere all by ourselves. We have to have social interaction with people, and God saw that it wasn't good for Adam to be alone, and even all the animals that He created, there was none that could be a suitable helper for Adam. You know, dog is man's best friend, dogs are great, cats are great, but they don't really replace people, do they? And God saw that and made a remedy for it. In Genesis 2:18, it says, and the Lord said, it is not good that man should be alone. I will make him an help meet for him. There are some people out there, and I don't necessarily take issue with the term, but they take, when it says, I will make him an help meet, and they take it and they turn that help meet, which means a help suitable, they take the two words and they put them together and they call it a help meet. And which, you know, I don't have a problem with so much, but they talk about that the wife is the husband's helpmeet, like it's some, they created a new word out of it. And it's not really, it's actually two words. There's like Doug Phillips in the, what's that organization he has called? I get a bunch of blank stares, nobody knows what I'm talking about. It irritates me when I can't remember. Anyway, he's got this family organization, and they're big on this. They always talk about the helpmeet, the woman's the helpmeet. And so they kind of created a new word. I guess probably in 20 years from now it'll be in the dictionary and everybody will use it. So anyway, God made Eve for Adam out of one of his ribs, as we just read that in Genesis 2:21 earlier. So God was the first surgeon that we have in the earth. He used some anesthesia. He put Adam to sleep. He took out one of his ribs, and he created him a woman. It'd be nice if it was that easy nowadays, where God just puts you to sleep and makes you a wife. Save all the dating and all that junk. She was called woman because she was taken out of man. So that's what woman means, out of man. My guess would be woo, or W-O means out of, if I had to take a guess. Woman means out of man. And Eve was created for Adam, not vice versa. You notice that God made Eve and helped meet for Adam. And Paul comments on this in 1 Corinthians 11, 8 through 9. You know, it's hard to preach when your teeth are chattering and your hands are shaking. 1 Corinthians 11, 8 through 9. Paul says, For the man is not of the woman, but the woman of the man. Neither was the man created for the woman, but the woman for the man. So woman was created for man, for a help meet for him. Now, there might be a lot of feminists out there that don't like that idea, but that's how God did it. And there's nothing certainly wrong with being created as a helper for your husband. No, nothing bad about that whatsoever. Marriage was God's plan when he created Adam and Eve. If you look in Genesis 2:24, God didn't create Eve just to be Adam's buddy, just to be a friend to hang out with once in a while. He created Eve with the view of marriage, with marriage in view. Genesis 2:24, therefore shall a man leave his father and mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. Now your wife should be your friend too, and should be your buddy and you know, all that kind of thing. But she's obviously more than that too. Jesus affirmed that marriage between one man and one woman was God's plan from the very beginning. So all these so-called gay rights activists out there need to go read this verse. This is how God created things from the beginning. Mark 10, 6 through 9. But from the beginning of the creation, God made them male and female. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh, so they are no more twain, but one flesh. What therefore God hath joined together, let not man put asunder. We read a similar verse in Matthew. But that was God from the beginning of the creation. That was God's plan for man and woman to be husband and wife. Now God created Adam and Eve. God did not create Adam and Steve. God did not create Madam and Eve. God did not create Adam and Eve's. And God did not create Adam's and Eve. He created Adam and Eve. One man, one woman for life. That's what marriage is. Anything else that's called marriage that is not that is not marriage. It's a contradiction of terms. If the gays want to have what they call marriage, they ought to come up with another name for it instead of perverting the name of marriage. Therefore, any type of quote marriage, such as quote gay marriage, which is anything but gay — gay means happy and giddy and that kind of thing — any type of marriage, such as gay marriage, that differs from God's original definition of marriage is a wicked, ungodly abomination. Look at Romans 1, 26 through 27. I know I just talked about this a week or two ago, but I think it bears repeating. Romans 1, 26 through 27. For this God gave them up unto vile affections, for even their women did change the natural use into that which is against nature. And likewise also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust one toward another, men with men, working that which is unseemly, and receiving in themselves that recompense of their error, which was meet. That's what God thinks of holy homosexual matrimony. It's anything but holy. It's an abomination, and God hates it. God also restricts marriage to one man and one woman for life. I just mentioned that, but look at Romans 12 or 7 and verse 2, and I'll give you the verse for it. Romans 7 and verse 2. This is a lifelong institution. This isn't just something that you get into and see if it's going to work out. If it doesn't work out, you just move on. That's not how it works. Romans 7 and verse 2 says, "For the woman which hath an husband is bound by the law to her husband, so long as he liveth. But if the husband be dead, she is loosed from the law of her husband." You can think of marriage as the Hotel California. You can check in anytime you like, but you can never leave, if you know the Eagles song that I'm talking about. Is that a good analogy with the Hotel California song? I don't know, especially since Anton LaVey is supposedly in the little window in the picture on the album and everything. But anyway, you get my point. I don't even know if that's Anton LaVey in there anyway, but supposedly they say it is. When a marriage covenant is entered into by a man and a woman, God joins them together and binds them to that covenant. So let's first of all look and see that it is a covenant. In Malachi 2 and verse 14, this is the last book of the Old Testament. Malachi 2 and verse 14. God says, "Yet ye say, wherefore? Because the Lord hath been witness between thee and the wife of thy youth, against whom thou hast dealt treacherously. Yet is she thy companion and the wife of thy covenant." She's the wife of thy covenant. Marriage is a covenant. It's a covenant, it's a compact, a contract struck between two people, man and woman, to be bound together in matrimony for life. And God is privy to that covenant. God binds them to that covenant. He holds them to it. Matthew 19 and verse 6, this is different than any other covenant that men can strike, because God is a party to it. And if you remember that sermon, I guess Pastor Mott did it here, and then it's also on the website from when I did it in Cincinnati on adultery and church membership. I went into that extensively. Matthew 19 and verse 6. It says, "Wherefore they are no more twain, but one flesh. What therefore God hath joined together, let not man put asunder." It is God that joins man and wife together, and he holds them to that covenant. And he's not going to let you just throw that covenant off anytime you feel like it. "Now therefore, while they are both alive, if one of them marries another person, he or she commits adultery." Look at Romans 7 and verse 3. There are two exceptions to this, and I will get into that in this study. But I'm speaking in general right now. You're bound together for life, and if you marry somebody else, you commit adultery. Romans 7 and verse 3. "So then if while her husband liveth, she be married to another, she shall be called an adulteress. But if her husband be dead, she is free from that law, so that she is no adulteress, though she be married to another man." So once you get married, you're in there, and you can't marry somebody else. Even if you divorce or separate, you can't marry somebody else. It doesn't matter, like I just said, it doesn't matter if they've divorced. The remarriage of either of them to another is adultery. Now, this is something that I didn't used to understand years ago before I was converted. I thought, probably like most people nowadays think, that, you know, it's only adultery if you do it whenever you're married. I mean, you're still living together and everything. But if you divorce and go your separate ways, then you can marry somebody else, and that's not adultery. That's what I used to think, until I read what Jesus said. And then I changed my mind when I saw that honestly, I was shocked. When I read this for the first time, I don't remember when it was, years ago, and I thought, that can't be. I mean, that just seems so harsh. And you just look around, you think of everybody you know, you're like, wait a minute, you mean all these people are living in adultery? Yeah, that's what it means. Mark 10, 11 through 12. Mark 10, 11 through 12, "And he saith unto them, Whosoever shall put away his wife and marry another committeth adultery. And if a woman shall put away her husband and be married to another, she committeth adultery." So it works man or woman, either way. You can't put away your wife and marry another. And Luke 16 and verse 18, Jesus said likewise. This is a quote from either this is the same instance that he spoke before, or he's speaking it again and saying very similar things. In Luke 16 and verse 18, "Whosoever putteth away his wife and marrieth another committeth adultery, and whosoever marrieth her that is put away from her husband committeth adultery. So once you get in there, you're stuck. Adultery is violation of the marriage bed. The voluntary sexual intercourse of a married person with one of the opposite sex, whether unmarried or married to another, the former case being technically designated single, the latter double adultery. So if one person, if a husband goes off and has a fling with somebody, that's single adultery. If he has a fling with somebody that's married as well, that's double adultery because there's two people that are committing adultery. But it's a violation of the marriage bed. Adultery can be committed in the heart as well as physically. You look in Matthew 5, 27 through 28. It's something that obviously can be committed physically when you physically have sex with somebody that you're not married to, or if you're married and you have sex with somebody else besides your wife or husband, that's clearly adultery, but it can also be in the heart. Most sins can be committed in the heart. You can commit murder in the heart. If you hate your brother, you commit murder in your heart. You know, if you think about and contemplate stealing something that somebody else's, well, you're sinning in your heart. I mean, you're sinning in your thoughts. You don't actually have to do it to be guilty of the sin before God. In Matthew 5, 27 through 28, he says, "Ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you, that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in his heart." So you're just as guilty in the eyes of God if you look on a woman to lust after her in your heart than if you actually went and did what you thought about in your heart. You're just as guilty before God. You may not be as guilty before the church if they don't know about it. It's in your head and they don't find out. But if they find out about it, you're just as guilty and you could be put out of the church for lusting in your heart if it was found out. And it can be. Your sin will find you out if you continue to do something like that. God will bring things out. In Job 31 and verse 1, this is way back when. I mean, these laws go back, predating the law of Moses. Job was around a long, long time ago. And Job understood the nature of marriage and the covenant of it. It says there in Job 31 and verse 1, "I made a covenant with mine eyes. Why then should I think upon a maid?" The covenant of marriage is a covenant with the eyes. You covenant that you will not look on another woman or another man as the object of your love. That's what you do. It's the covenant of the eyes. You, when you get married, you say, "I'm putting the blinders on and I'm not looking at anybody else besides you, my husband or my wife, is the object of my love, specifically of my sexual love." That is what the covenant of marriage is all about. This stupid idea that sinners have out there that, oh, I can look but I can't touch. I'm sure everybody's heard that crap. And that's garbage. Absolute garbage. And no Christian should ever say, nobody should say anything like that, but especially no Christian should ever say anything foolish like that. Proverbs 6 and verse 25. Proverbs 6 and verse 25 says, "Lust not after her beauty in thine heart, neither let her take thee with her eyelids," talking about the strange woman. But he says, don't lust after her beauty in your heart. It's the same when you're doing it in your heart or you're doing it physically. And lastly, in Proverbs 24 and verse 9. Proverbs 24 in verse 9, "The thought of foolishness is sin, and the scorner is an abomination to men." Just wanted to get that. Just the thought of foolishness, thinking of something foolish or sinful, is sin. And these verses are, if you notice, they're all aimed at men. "Whoso looketh on a woman, why should I think upon a maid? Lust not after her in thine heart." Men have an issue with this more than women. Men are more driven by the lust of the eyes, by the sight of the eyes, men are. You know, women don't get all that excited when they see their husband standing there in his boxers. You know, it's just really not all that exciting, right? I've been told. I wouldn't know. But anyway, men, it's a different story. You know, men are excited by the eyes. Now, there are two exceptions to this rule of no marriage after divorce. The first one is, if one spouse commits fornication, the other spouse can put them away and marry another. Matthew 19 and verse 9. I've debated this text and this point extensively with people in the past, two people I can think of in particular. Some people really take issue with this. Some people, for whatever reason, they say that there is no marriage after divorce, period, for any reason. And they hold strongly to this. And I've had this debate with a girl one time, and I had this debate with a guy that used to be in our church in Cincinnati who is no longer in the church. Matthew 19:9, Jesus said, "And I say unto you, whosoever shall put away his wife, except it be for fornication, and shall marry another, committeth adultery. And whoso marrieth her that is put away doth commit adultery." Now, there's an exception clause in there. There's a little, not a parenthetical clause, but a comma clause, you could say. If we take out that exception clause, let's read it without that. It would say, "And I say unto you, whosoever shall put away his wife and shall marry another committeth adultery." But you put the exception clause in there. That says that anybody, without the exception clause, any husband that puts away his wife and marries another commits adultery. That's very plain. But put the exception clause in there. "Whosoever shall put away his wife, except it be for fornication, and shall marry another, committeth adultery." If fornication has happened, then the husband can put away the wife and marry another and not be guilty of adultery. There is an exception. That's why Jesus said, except. I've literally argued with people and said, "I don't understand these exceptions." It says except. That's why there's an exception. It's not rocket science. Fornication is voluntary sexual intercourse between a man in restricted use, an unmarried man, and an unmarried woman, in Scripture extended to adultery. So if a husband, and I'll just do it because Jesus speaks of it as the man in this case, if a husband has a wife that has committed fornication or adultery, if you're married, fornication is adultery. If you're not married, then it's just fornication, unless you happen to be fornicating with a person that is married, and then it would be adultery and fornication. All adultery is fornication. All fornication is not adultery. But anyway, if a husband's married to a wife and she commits fornication / adultery with another man, then he is free to put her away and he can marry another. That marriage covenant has been broken and dissolved. Broken and dissolved. And he is free to remarry. She's not, but he is in that case. Now, I want you to pay attention to the next points that I'm going to make here. Points B down through K. This is very important. I have not taught on this before, I don't think. And I didn't even, I understood this, but I didn't really have a good scriptural basis for it until I started putting this study together. And the definitions in the Scripture make it abundantly clear and obvious. So I want you to pay attention, and I want you to make sure you get this. To put away, the phrase, to put away, is to divorce. They are the same thing. Look at Matthew 5 and verse 32. Matthew 5 and verse 32. Jesus said, "But I say unto you that whosoever shall put away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, causeth her to commit adultery, and whosoever shall marry her that is divorced, committeth adultery." Now you see the words that Jesus uses there. Whosoever shall put away his wife, okay? And then he says, whosoever shall marry her that is divorced. Put away and divorced are the same thing. But I got more verses for you. Matthew 19 and verse 7. And I got the definitions of the word that will make this crystal clear. Matthew 19 and verse 7. They say unto him, "Why did Moses then command to give a writing of divorcement and to put her away?" Writing and divorcement, putting her away. They're the same thing. They happen together. But one happens before the other, as I will show in a minute. Mark 10 and verse 4. Mark 10 and verse 4. This is a parallel text to Matthew 19:7. And they said, "Moses suffered to write a bill of divorcement and to put her away." Write the bill of divorcement, put her away. These things clearly go together. Now here's some definitions for you. Put away comes from the word put. This definition is found in the definition of the verb put. Because it's a phrase, the dictionary doesn't generally define phrases, but sometimes you will find phrases in the definitions of verbs or nouns. So put away, this is found way down there. I had to dig for a while. Number 39, it means to send away, dismiss, get rid of, to reject, specifically to divorce. So there you have it. To put away is to divorce and to send away. And I have that sent to send away underlined because we will get to that down in point G, and we will see how the scripture shows this as well. Divorcement, as Jesus said in Matthew 19:7, right, or a bill of divorcement. Divorcement is the action of divorcing or the fact of being divorced, dissolution of the marriage tie, divorce. Now, to divorce in the verb, like if you divorce your wife or your husband, to divorce is to dissolve the marriage contract between husband and wife by process of law. That's important. By process of law. To separate by divorce from. Number two, it's to put away. Divorce is to put away a spouse, to repudiate. And I cite number two there because it cites Tyndale's Bible. That was one of the previous English Bibles back in the 1500s. It cites Matthew 5:32, whosoever marrieth her that is divorced breaketh wedlock, or the King James says committeth adultery. But anyway, OED cites that verse to say that this is a usage of the word to put away. So to put, or a divorce. So divorce means to put away, and they cite Tyndale to show that this, the divorce means to put away. And put away means to divorce, so you can see them in their synonyms of each other, they define each other. Divorce in the noun form, like if we're talking about divorce, it is legal dissolution of a marriage by a court or other competent body. Note that, it's important, by a court or other competent body. This isn't something you just go do on your own, just say I'm divorced because I said I am. Or according to forms recognized in the country, nation, or tribe. Formerly and still often, example historically or anthropologically, used in the widest sense, hence including the formal putting away of or separation from a spouse by a heathen or a barbarian. I'm going to skip part of that definition. It's talking about King Henry VIII and all this stuff that we don't care about. And you get down to the bottom and it says, but in strict legal use now applied in English-speaking countries like us, like the country that the King James was translated from, only now in strict use, now applied in English-speaking countries, only to the dissolution by decree of court of what was in itself a legal marriage upon grounds sanctioned by the law and upon evidence accepted by the court. So I quoted all that and read all that to show you that divorce is a legal proceeding in a court of law. Now you just don't do it yourself and say, I'm divorced because I want to be here because I think I am. Now, get this. This is important. Writing a bill of divorce precedes putting away a spouse. This was true in the Old Testament. This is true in the New Testament. First, the Old Testament. Deuteronomy 24 and verse 1 through 3. Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 3. It says, when a man hath taken a wife and married her, and it come to pass that she find no favor in his eyes, because he hath found some uncleanness in her, then let him write her a bill of divorcement and give it in her hand and send her out of his house. You see, he writes the bill of divorcement first, puts it in her hand, then sends her out. And we saw that in to put away is to send away. So we see there that he's putting her away. He's giving her a bill of divorcement and putting her away or sending her away. Verse 2 through 3. And when she has departed out of his house, she may go and be another man's wife. See, the law has changed. In the law of Moses, he could put her away, she'd go be another man's wife. Jesus tightened this law up. And if the latter husband hate her and write a bill of divorcement and give it into her hand and sendeth her out of his house. See, there you go again. Write her a bill of divorcement, then send her away, or then put her away. Or if the latter husband die, which took her to be his wife. And that's all I need from that text. But the writing of the divorcement comes first, then she's put away. Matthew 19 and verse 7. We already read it. Let's read it again. Matthew 19 and verse 7. They say unto him, why did Moses then command to give a writing of divorcement and to put her away? That's what they're talking about. They're referring to that verse there in Deuteronomy 24. Therefore, a man has not put away his wife until they are formally and legally divorced. You can't say, oh, I've put her away, she's put away, I'm going to go and marry somebody else now, when you haven't formally and legally been divorced. Because divorce comes before putting away. You have to be legally divorced, then you put her away, then you can marry somebody else, and not before. Therefore, for a man to marry a woman after his wife has committed adultery, but before they are formally and legally divorced, is for him to commit adultery. You want to get yourself into some trouble, have your wife go commit adultery, put her away, quote unquote, without actually going through the formal proceeding of a divorce, then marry somebody else, you're going to be the one that's an adulterer. Then you're really going to be in trouble. You'd be in trouble with the state and the church, for that matter. Now, this is important. This includes dating or having a romantic relationship with another woman, which would at the least be adultery in the man's heart, Matthew 5:28 and Job 31:1, and possibly even physically adultery, before he's formally and legally divorced. Let me read it without the parenthetical clause. This includes dating or having a romantic relationship with another woman before he's formally or legally divorced. You can't go out there and date somebody before you're divorced. You're still married. You're still bound legally to that covenant of marriage. And to say, well, I put her away, the divorce isn't final yet, I'm going to go date somebody else. No, that does not work. You cannot do that. Therefore, a man dating another woman prior to his divorce being formally and legally finalized is no different than a man dating another woman when he was happily married to his wife before she committed adultery, since in both cases, he is still legally married to his wife because a legal divorce is not yet complete. It's no different. When you're happily married, you are legally married, you are legally bound to your wife, and you certainly could not go out there and date another woman when you're married to your wife, obviously. If your wife has committed adultery, but she has not yet been put away and the divorce is not yet finalized, you cannot date another woman because you're still married. It's no different than it before the spouse committed adultery. You cannot do that. All right, enough of that. The next point. If a believer is married to an unbeliever, and the unbeliever departs from the believer is free from the bonds of that marriage. So adultery was the first case in which a man could put away his wife and marry another. There's also another case. If a believer is married to an unbeliever and the unbeliever departs, the believer then is freed. 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 15. First Corinthians 7:15. But if the unbelieving depart, let him depart. A brother or a sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God hath called us to peace. This is speaking, Paul's instruction here in this part of 1 Corinthians 7 is talking about believers. First he's talking about believers, then he's talking about believers and unbelievers being married together, and what if they have to remain married or what the deal is. And he says in verse 15, he's specifically talking about a believer married to an unbeliever, and if the unbeliever depart, then the believer is not bound to that marriage. Depart means to go apart or away with its derived senses. It's to go asunder, to part or separate from each other, to take leave of each other. As I said, when the unbeliever departs, it's saying if the unbeliever goes away or leaves you, okay, that's what departing is. No, the departing of the unbeliever could be departing the marriage, or it could be departing the believer geographically. I'm not talking about when your husband leaves for work in the morning. You say, that's it, I'm out. I'm done with him. He departed. Never mind, he's going to be back in 8 hours. You know, or when he goes away on a fishing trip for the weekend or whatever, you don't start filing the divorce papers and say, hey, I'm free. No, that's not what I'm talking about, and everybody knows that. But if he departs and he just says, you know what, I'm out of here. I'm moving wherever, across, I'm moving to another state, and I'm not coming back. Well, and you're a believer, and he's not, you can put him away, and God doesn't bind you to that marriage covenant anymore. Or if he says, I'm divorcing you, I'm leaving, and he's the unbeliever, you're the believer, God does not bind you to that marriage covenant anymore. Now, the bondage in the context of this is being bound to a wife. That's what the bondage that Paul's referring to there is. In 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 27, just a few verses later, Paul says, "Art thou bound unto a wife? Seek not to be loosed. Art thou loosed from a wife? Seek not a wife." So he refers to their being married as being bound unto a wife. That's what this bondage is, and I'll show you the definitions will prove this out. Bondage is the tenure of a bond or bond after the Norman conquest, tenure in villainage, the service rendered by a bond. I honestly don't even know what in the world that's even talking about. Number two, the position or condition of a serf or slave, servitude, serfdom, slavery, the condition of being bound or tied up, that which binds. Now, bound in the past participle or the adjective is made fast by a tie, confined, fastened down, bandaged, which can also be figuratively. So, and if you notice, I defined these words, I believe, in the slavery study just on Wednesday. So anyway, bondage is to be bound, and to be bound is to be made fast by tie or confined. It makes sense, right? You're fastened down or bandaged. Why do you think that marriage is called the ball and chain? You're bound. You're held down. You're stuck. You ever feel like you're in prison? Come on, be honest with me. You married people, you feel like you're in a prison? It's because you are. You're bound. You got that shackle around your leg and you can't get away. That's the way it is. Now, it's the brother or the sister, the believer, that is, that is no longer under bondage if the unbeliever departs. The believer is free to remarry, but the unbeliever is not, just as the spouse who is the victim of adultery is free to remarry, but the spouse who committed adultery is not free to remarry. So, if the unbeliever departs, the believer is freed, but the unbeliever is not freed from the marriage. Now, in that the person is an unbeliever, they're probably not going to give two hoots about what God says about marriage, and they're going to go out there and marry whoever they want anyway. But, technically speaking, the unbeliever is not free to remarry, but the believer who is left is free to remarry. And it works the same way with the person that commits adultery. The person that commits adultery, yeah, the marriage contract has been broken and disannulled for the innocent party, not for the guilty party, though. The guilty party cannot go out and remarry, though the innocent party can, and I covered that in that other study extensively. God, and some people might ask, why? Why would God make this exception for a believer married to an unbeliever? Why did he do this? Well, I think one good answer to that would be that God honors those who honor him. In 1 Samuel 2:30, this principle was given. 1 Samuel 2 and verse 30. Jump down to the middle of the verse. But now he, the Lord, saith, be it far from me, for them that honor me I will honor, and them that despise me shall be lightly esteemed. Them that honor me, God says, I will honor. God honors them that honor him. You stick with God, he'll stick with you. And he'll be in your corner to take care of you. I remember Tim, my pastor, told me this verse when I was going through that terrible situation with my wife when I was in Iraq. And she left me for the reason of being an unbeliever, not and hating and despising the church and wanting nothing to do with it. And Tim told me this very verse, never forgot it. God honors them that honor him. A believer is not free to put away an unbeliever if the unbeliever is pleased to live with him, though. So God just doesn't give you a freebie that if you're married to an unbeliever, you can just put away that unbeliever anytime you feel like it. That doesn't work. It's only if they leave you. You cannot leave them if they're pleased to dwell with you. 1 Corinthians 7, 12 through 14. 1 Corinthians 7, 12 through 14. Paul says, but to the rest speak I, not the Lord. If a brother hath a wife that believeth not, and she be pleased to dwell with him, let him not put her away. And the woman which hath an husband that believeth not, if he be pleased to dwell with her, let her not leave him. So if you are a believer and you're married to an unbeliever, then you stick with that unbeliever. And you make the best of that marriage that you can. You're not free to leave him or her. And you're not free to mistreat them or anything else. You treat them just as if they were a believer in the marriage as far as that's concerned. And you never know, like Peter says in 1 Peter 3, that a wife's godly conversation may win over an unbelieving husband. And that may be instrumental in his conversion or in her conversion. It's happened before. Though he hates it, God does permit divorce under certain guidelines. Now there are, on the other end of this spectrum, there are people that say that divorce is not allowed, period, for any reason. And the scripture doesn't support that either. The scripture does allow for divorce under certain guidelines, but just remember, it's something that God does not like. God hates it. He suffers it. He allows it. He allows a lot of things he doesn't like. But this is not God's plan, and this is not what God wants. Malachi 2 and verse 16. It says, "For the Lord, the God of Israel, saith that he hateth putting away. For one covereth violence with his garment, saith the Lord of hosts. Therefore, take heed to your spirit that you deal not treacherously." God hates putting away. God hates divorce. He does not like it at all. But God permits divorce. He does permit believers to separate or divorce, but there's one caveat. They must remain unmarried or be reconciled to each other. One of the two. You must either remain unmarried all your days or remarry the spouse that you were married to. Those are your only two options, or wait until they die. You know, if they die or if they go and be married to somebody else, then they've committed adultery and they've broken the covenant. But as long as the two of you are alive and faithful, then you cannot be married to another person. 1 Corinthians 7:10-11. Paul says, "And unto the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord, let not the wife depart from her husband. But and if she depart, let her remain unmarried, or be reconciled to her husband, and let not the husband put away his wife." So they can split. I mean, people say, you know, you have people use the objection, and it's a good one. Well, what if a woman's married to a guy that's beating her up all the time? Should she just stay with him? No. She should. My counsel to her would be no. Don't stay with him. Leave. You can leave. You can't remarry, but leave. Or my counsel would be, and this may sound crazy, get yourself a gun, wait for that bastard to come in and beat you up again, and kill him in self-defense. That would be a way to take care of it, which I wouldn't have a problem with either. You're defending your own life. Pardon my language and my harshness. So don't come to me in this church and say, "I got a problem beating my wife." My counsel to your wife may be to get rid of you. Anyway. If you do have a problem, you can come to me and we'll try to work it out. I'm just kidding, but anyway, something you definitely need to repent of. I would be quick to tell you. Though they can separate, Though they can separate, they cannot marry another person as long as they are both living, as this would be adultery because they're still bound to the covenant of their marriage. So, that's why they can't remarry, because that marriage covenant is still binding. You may be living separate places, but that God still considers that covenant made, that you are still bound by that covenant, even though you may not be living as if you're married. Romans 7:2-3. Romans 7:2-3. "For the woman which hath an husband is bound by the law to her husband as long as he liveth. But if the husband be dead, she is loosed from the law of her husband. So then if while her husband liveth, she be married to another man, she shall be called an adulteress. But if her husband be dead, she is free from that law, so that she is no adulteress, though she be married to another man." So as long as you're still living, as long as you're both still living, no remarriage can't happen. You can stay separated, you know, maybe you need some cooling off period or whatever. Sometimes that happens. You know, sometimes a little bit of separation can do a lot of good, but no remarriage. Now, though separation and divorce are permitted, but certainly not encouraged, you better think long and hard about breaking your vow to love and cherish each other, for better or for worse, till death do you part. You better think long and hard about that. That's a serious, you took a vow. And you said that I'm going to love you And better or worse, sickness and in health, till death do us part. And you better take that very seriously. You better think about that before you decide to go separating or divorcing. Divorce is devastating to children. It is. I know. I've been through it. As a child, I've been through it. It's devastating. It's awful. The pain for children never ends, even when they become adults. And I can attest to this. It never ends. It's not the same. I mean, obviously I'm not in the same pain level that I was when I was 11 or 12 or however, whatever age it was. But it never ends. It's something that always sticks with you. The scars always last. And there are just logistical complications for the rest of your life too, because who do I invite? Mom or dad to the birthday party, the graduation, the whatever. I mean, there's always these issues. Some people can get along pretty well and it's not as big of an issue. Some people don't. But anyway, it's a headache. And you just think about your kids before you go doing that. Divorce is ultimately the result of selfishness on the part of at least one, and almost always both, but at least one of the spouses, that is selfishness is a root cause of it. And usually it takes two to tango. You know, usually things don't just happen in a vacuum. One person is just the perfect husband or the perfect wife, and the other one was just such a dirtbag. That normally is not the case. Maybe once in a while. I mean, you got Nabal and Abigail. You know, Abigail seemed like a pretty good girl, and Nabal, by his very name, was a fool. So, you know, once in a while, why would a good girl marry to Nabal? I don't know. But anyway, usually it's the result of selfishness. Think about your children before you decide to give up on your marriage. Your decision will have lifelong consequences for both them and you. It's not just like breaking up with your girlfriend. It's a big, big deal, big difference. Now, though marriage is for most people, it's not for all. Paul said, by permission, not by commandment, that it's better for a person to remain single as he was. So this was kind of Paul's opinion, you could say. The Lord gave him permission to say this, though this was not the Lord's commandment, but this was what Paul thought, and he was a wise man, and I think we ought to consider this. 1 Corinthians 7:6-9. 1 Corinthians 7:6-9. Paul says, but I speak this by permission and not by commandment, for I would that all men were even as I myself. See, Paul was a single man. He was not married, never married. But every man hath his proper gift of God, one after this manner and another after that. Is that all the further I was going to read? No, I was going to read through 9. I say therefore to the unmarried and widows, it is good for them if they abide even as I. But if they cannot contain, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn. That's to burn with passion. If you can't control yourself, get married. If you have somebody to get married to, obviously. Being single is a good thing. 1 Corinthians 7:8. He said, I say therefore to the unmarried and widows, it's good for them if they abide even as I. It's not a bad thing. People look at it like singlehood is just a curse. It's a terrible thing, and God's just some mean monster in the sky that hasn't sent a wife or a husband across your path yet. It's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. Marriage is a good thing, too. I mean, they're both good things. They both have blessings and benefits to both of them. I've been both. I know what I'm talking about. Being single allows you to care for the things of God instead of caring for a wife or for a husband. 1 Corinthians 7:32-34. Paul says, but I would have you without carefulness. He that is unmarried careth for the things that belong to the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But he that is married careth for the things that are of the world, how he may please his wife. There is a difference also between a wife and a virgin. The unmarried woman careth for the things of the Lord, that she may be holy both in body and in spirit. But she that is married careth for the things of the world, how she may please her husband. So everybody knows this. Everybody that's married knows this, that if you're married, a lot of your energies are taken up caring for your husband or your wife, taking care of them and spending time with them. And you don't have as much time to spend with the Lord. You don't have as much time to spend reading the Bible, praying, having quiet time of contemplation and meditation with God. It just doesn't happen. It's just the way it is. It's not a bad thing necessarily when you get married, that you don't have as much time to spend with the Lord. That's what Paul says. I mean, it's just a fact of life. But there are definitely benefits to being single, and that's one of them. It allows you to attend upon the Lord without distraction. Verse 35. And this I speak for your own profit, not that I may cast a snare upon you. See, Paul's not saying, I'm not telling you that being single is a blessing just to try to make your life miserable, not to cast a snare on you, but for that which is comely or good, and that ye may attend upon the Lord without distraction. This is why Paul is saying it's a good idea to be single, if you can, if you have that gift, because you can attend upon God without distraction. This can be a really good gift for ministers. I realize most ministers are married, and the qualifications for a minister to be the husband of one wife, so I mean, that qualification shows that most men that go into the ministry are married, but Paul is certainly an exception to that. I'm an exception to that. There's a few of us out there. 2 Timothy 2 and verse 4, this can be a good blessing, though, for a minister. It says in 2 Timothy 2 and verse 4, no man that warreth entangleth himself with the affairs of this life, that he may please him who hath chosen him to be a soldier. So I don't have to entangle myself with the affairs of this life like somebody that's married would with a wife or kids. You know, maybe that'll happen someday, maybe it won't, but at least at this point, I'm enjoying the non-distraction of life and trying to make the best of it. Now, given the present distress, as Paul talked about in 1 Corinthians 7, and the distress that may be yet future, it might not be a bad idea to be single for anybody, for everyone for that matter. 1 Corinthians 7, 25 and 26. I'm not sure what this present distress was that Paul's referring to here in Corinth. I mean, probably maybe political upheaval or something. Who knows? I mean, the world history is full of all kinds of terrible things that people have suffered. So who knows what the present distress was at that time. But he says there in verse 25 and 26, now concerning virgins, I have no commandment of the Lord, yet I give my judgment as one that hath obtained mercy of the Lord to be faithful. I suppose, therefore, that this is good for the present distress. I say that it is good for a man so to be. So whatever the present distress was, Paul says, you know, it's probably a good idea to be single right now. I mean, you think about it. If you were in Jerusalem in the days, whenever the siege was happening by Rome, and, you know, people were starving to death and eating their own kids and everything, wouldn't have been a bad idea to be single, and you just kind of have yourself to take care of, and you don't have to worry about the burden of taking care of a wife and family. So present distress might not be a bad idea. In the distress that we might face, you know, it might not be a bad idea to be single. So something to think about anyway. If you do end up being single for life, as Paul was, just remember that our time here on earth is short, and it's not going to matter, and I put in italics, a relatively short period of time, whether you were married here on earth or not. It's not going to matter, and I say relatively, like, I don't know, 50 years or less, it's not going to matter two hoots whether you were married here or not. Marriage is just for this life. So it's a great blessing, but if you happen to never get to take part in that blessing, it's just for a short time. We just have a few laps down here. It's like the song we sang this morning. And I can't remember it was the last line of it anyway. Now I don't remember the line of it. You know, there's another George Bushism for you. But anyway, I should look it up. Maybe I'll look it up at the end of the service. What's it say? I don't remember. Anyway, I'm going to quit digging while I'm still above ground here. It's a relatively short period of time. 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 29. Paul said, but this I say, brethren, the time is short. It remaineth that both they that have wives be as though they had none, and they that reap as though they wept, or they that weep as though they wept not, and they that rejoice as though they rejoiced not, and they that buy as though they bought, or though they possessed not. And they that use this world is not abusing it, for the fashion of this world passeth away. So the time is short. It doesn't really matter in the grand scheme of things whether you were married or not, because it's just for this life. There is no marriage in heaven, So there is no eternal benefit to marriage. There's certainly a temporal and an earthly benefit to marriage, but there's no eternal benefit to marriage because it doesn't extend on past this life. When you die, that's it. You're no longer married, and you're not going to get married again when you're in heaven. So if you don't find love in this life, it won't matter when the short life is over. It's just for down here. Luke 20, 34 through 36. We'll see that marriage does not transcend the grave. Luke 20, 34 through 36. Jesus said, or it says here, and Jesus answering said unto them, the children of this world marry and are given in marriage, but they that which shall be accounted worthy to obtain that world and the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage. Neither can they die any more, for they are equal unto the angels and are the children of God, being the children of the resurrection. So marriage is only for this world. It's not for that world. You don't marry or give, you're not married or given in marriage in that world. It's only for down here. So, and that's kind of comfort I take in that. You know, some people are never blessed to be married. But just think, you know, when you get to heaven, we're all married to Christ anyway. So we're all going to be married, just not in the same way we're married down here, those of us who are. Now, celibacy is a gift that some have, but it hasn't been given to all. 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 7. So, I mean, the things that I'm saying here really, I mean, that's why I'm not spending a whole ton of time. I did do a whole sermon on finding contentment being single back in January of this year. It's on the website if you didn't get to hear it. I did it back in Cincinnati. But majority of the people are married or will be married, so I'm probably only talking to a small fraction of the population, but still, I think it's important to speak. I mean, if you can help one person, it's worth preaching it. 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 7, Paul says, for I would that all men were even as I myself, but every man hath his proper gift of God, one after this manner, and another after that. So, most people don't have the gift that Paul had. Most people don't have the gift of celibacy. There are a few that do. Now, if you don't have the gift of celibacy, it is better for you to marry than to burn, as Paul said in verse 9. But if they cannot contain, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn. So if you are, desiring to be married, you're going out there, you're dating people, and you're involved in a relationship, I mean, I wouldn't even really question the fact of whether you've been given the gift of celibacy, because it's pretty obvious that you haven't, and you may as well go ahead and get married. It's certainly better to marry than to burn. But if you're content and you can be by yourself and you don't really mind not being married, you don't even really think about it, then maybe you have that gift and you can use it and use it for the glory of God. So next time we're going to talk about the roles and responsibilities in marriage of the wife, primarily of the wife. And then the week after that, it'll be of the husband. So I hope that this study has been beneficial for you, and I thank you for your kind and patient attention.